Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. Larry Dahlberg is a guest I've wanted to have on the show for some time now. You may know of him as the man who created the Dahlberg Diver, but he is also the inventor of Flashaboo and various other fishing innovations. In this episode of Anchored, Larry and I discuss his long-running television series, The Hunt for Big Fish, how he got his start, and his thoughts on fishing the thermocline, ideal water temperature, how to properly fish his fly, and so much more.
I was born in a little town of 931 people in Burnett County, Wisconsin. It was the largest town in the county. And I was born December 12, 1949. I never thought I would leave Burnett County. I had everything I needed right there.
We'll come back to your youth, but why did you leave?
Well, I had to get a job. So, where it all started, I grew up in that area. And my grandfather, maternal grandfather had a whole bunch of kids, lived on, whatever he could, pulp, sturgeons. and then my other grandpa on the other side was in the electric business. They started the utility business. And as a little kid, my maternal grandpa would bring me along because it allowed him to kill twice as many fish. Two limits. But as a little kid, I was addicted to fishing. I remember the first fish I ever caught. I was 4 years old, and I had dropped this minnow down a hole through the ice, and the bobber went down. It was a little bobber my dad had carved. I remember carving them out of balsa wood in a basement. And I pulled up this fish hand over hand. That's how we did it then. And my dad was hollering. I was excited. And he was hollering because I was putting the line on the stove. It's monofilament, the light mono. I got the fish, but I didn't have any line left. And I still remember the smell of it and the sound of the Coleman lantern. And then in the springtime, I guess I was about four, he had rigged up an ice fishing stick that was too long for the ice fishing. It was just, cumbersome. It was made to fish outdoors. And he put a little fly reel on it. And he taught me how to flop it back and forth. And we tied little black gnats out of just black chenille and a little bit of red marabou out the back. And I'd stand in the waist-deep water in the spring and catch sunfish flopping this little gnat around. And he had his... he had a Granger Victory three-piece bamboo gray rod, A-weight. GBF is what they were back then, which is a whole nother issue. The line weights and your fly weenies drive me crazy, the variations. But that's a whole nother issue. But anyway, that's how I got started actually fly fishing. And then in the spring, they would fish walleyes. My mom wouldn't let my dad fish muskies until the freezer was adequately supplied with walleyes. And as a kid, I always wanted to go with him, and he would take me along in the spring walleye fishing, but I was not very capable, you know, as a four-year-old. So he made a deal with me that he gave me a Fluger scale cast. It was an old steel rod and this rubber lure with no hooks on it. I had to stand in a certain place in the backyard and cast this rubber thing under the swing set into a box. If I could do it 8 out of 10 times, I could go with it. How about the summer I was five, I was able to do that. And my mom stepped in and said, you got to take him with you. You promised. And that's when I learned how to row. He would put me in the middle seat of this Grumman sport boat, weighed 114 pounds, and put a couple cushions underneath. And I couldn't even see over the gunnels. And he just said, pull in the right oar. Pull in the right oar and push on the left oar. Okay, good. Pull on both oars, and then we'd be going down. He'd be casting, and then I'd get to fish when we anchored. Well, I don't know. By the time I was 11, I was pretty competent, and he would let me loose like on a Wednesday and pick me up on a Friday all alone, no food, no water. And he'd pick me up, you know, after a, you know, I'd float 15, 20 miles, you know, and just had my little spots where I camped, crawl underneath the boat. I didn't have a sleeping bags or tents or stuff like that. And they had little streams I could go up. I had a little stick stashed where I could, each little corner, you know, has got a little different character. So you need a 3-foot stick with 4 feet of mono or, I had these little 16 treble hooks I got from herders. And you get these little pink worms, you know, from underneath the stumps, and didn't need forks or spoons or anything. You just roast them on a stick and eat them and, you know, move on. No vegetables. Didn't have to brush my teeth. It was perfect. But anyway.
Did you say worms?
Yeah, we eat. I'd catch the brookies on these little pink worms.
Oh, okay. Brookies. I thought, okay. Gotcha. Yep.
Yeah, there's little teeny streams that ran into the main river that have brookies. The main river.
They're delicious.
Yeah, and I'd have sticks hidden in the woods. So I just, you know, I'd have a piece of mono and a size 16 treble, and you just, you know, maybe throw a couple worms in to tease them out of the corner, and then boing, boing, put them on the hook. And
I missed the brookie part and thought I heard you say that you roasted and ate worms. And I thought, oh,
no, I never was a big worm. But anyhow, I was like a little river rat. And there was a private club of, we called them the rich guys, that fly fished for smallmouth. And we'd sort of sneer at them as they went by. And it was a fishing club that had been around for years, started in the Mississippi. When the Army Corps ruined the Mississippi, they moved north. Anyhow, an old fella died, one of the guides, and they needed a fill-in, and they called my dad. Oh, help, Mr. Pillsbury's coming. We need it. Charlie died, and take the kid. He knows where the bass are. So I got a tryout with this guy, Philip Pillsbury, who was a really cool guy. He was started the Pillsbury Baking Company. The guy could throw a fly like no. Sitting down in a boat at age 70, he had a Pinky Gillum 3-piece, which he gave me. I have it in my collection. Last day he fished, he gave it to me. He could sit down at the seat with that back seat of the boat and go and throw 90 feet of sticky old gooey fly line with a loop so tight it'd go into a mailbox. Wonderful, wonderful man. But anyway, I got to start guiding, and I had an advantage. All the other guys that guided, they're old guys. They guided for years and years, but they fished walleyes with live bait when they're on their own. So they knew the banks and they knew the pools where the fish were. But as a little kid, the first thing I'd do is pull my boat up this creek. I'd go to the downside of the power dam, get a bunch of minnows, get a bunch of crayfish, get a bunch of stuff. And then I'd head down, I'd climb up in the trees. We hadn't invented polarized glasses yet. So you had to climb a tree to really good look at something. So I get up in these trees, I start throwing crap in and see what came out. And, you know, you're a little kid, you poke with the stick, see what it does. And so I knew where a lot of these fish were, like exactly where they were. Cause I, you know. And so the first fish, Mr. Pillsbury went over this, I had to first put some rocks in the front of the boat. He was so big, I'd get in, the bow of the boat was sticking out. It was like, I can't. So I had to put some big rocks in the front, and I took him to the spot he'd never been. He'd fished in this river for longer than I'd been alive. "Well, young man, I've never been over here before." I said, "Well, Cass, there's an orange rock. You can't see it unless you climb that tree, but there'll be a big bat." And boom, he caught one. And every place I told him there was going to be one, there was one. And he thought I was some sort of a savant. It wasn't like he'd cut one every cast, but there's one there. No, a little bit further into the right. Boom. And I got a full-time job. I did that for a number of years. And then a lot of the members of the club turned out. There's a guy named Chuck Walton. Held a world record permit on a fly for years and years and years. And he was the head chemist at 3M. Had a lot to do with them going into tapes and adhesives instead of just sandpaper. And then there's a fellow, Bert Cross, who was a president of 3M. And there's another fellow named Lou Jewett, who was the head of New Business Ventures. And these guys all like to fly fish, and they were selling microspheres. Those things that make fly lines float, also makes stop signs reflective. Oh. The microsphere is a giant invention for, I think Bert actually invented it. But anyway, he became the head chemist, and I guided these guys through high school, and then we had a bunch of other guys, and a bunch of them thought I should go to law school and be a U.S. senator, and the other ones thought I should go to work for 3M in this fly fishing, fly line, Cy Anglers deal. So I went to college, and I got a degree in I got a BS degree in English.
What was your plan? What were you going to do with that?
Well, English was what was easy for me. And both of the directions that were suggested, English was a very, very good major, not a teaching degree, but a writing degree. And I was always interested in the sciences. So I got a BS degree in English. It just turned out to be that way. I think it was a fairly unusual one. Anyhow, then the Vietnam War was happening. And anyway, there was a hiring freeze on at 3M because Jimmy Carter was president at that time. And so they suggested, well, what you ought to do is go to work for a sporting goods store and get some experience in this category. And there was a new store opening, and I went in and applied. And the guys asked me, well, did you ever do any fishing for, you ever do any fly fishing? I said, yeah. Used to guide some and blah, blah. We went out in the back alley with a fly rod. And they sort of gave me a little tryout, and I passed. And I went to work for this sporting goods company called Berger Brothers Sporting Goods. They just opened up in Minneapolis. And I did that for 3-4 years. And then decided that I didn't know if I liked that deal too much. And went back into the guiding business. They were going to sell the fishing camp that I had worked at because they couldn't find anybody to run it. And my wife and I went back up and ran that, and I started a guiding deal and then a manufacturer's rep business in the Midwest. And I could have had so many good lines. I was ended up the buyer at this store, and we had just creamed it. It turned into finally Holiday Stores, and they sold it to Gander Mountain. It was a juggernaut of a store. And I could have had all these high-end electronic lines and all this stuff. Instead, I thought, well, you know, the world needs fly fishing a little bit more. You know, there's not enough people to do it. So I went out and struggled and tried to pioneer the fly thing for a while. And then the people at In Fisherman, I worked out. I got a phone call out of the blue from Spencer Petros. He was a writer at the Fishing Facts magazine. Are you familiar with Fishing Facts magazine? He was filming with Roland Martin up in this neck of the woods, and they'd been here for several weeks and hadn't shot a foot of footage. And he said, I don't know where he'd even, you know, how he knew me, but do you think you could, you know, are you catching any fish? I said, I just got home. The water temps are exactly perfect. I'm going musky fishing tomorrow. And he showed up, and we made a little bit of a run, and I had this fish pretty well like exactly located. I went upstream a few hundred yards, shake stuff out. And they started winging their crap. And we get to, where the fish are going to be. I said, I dropped my hook. I said, they're going to be right here. I had the cameraman with me, and it's Peter Sprosen and Roland. I told him, here, use the, what to use. But they're not doing that. And I said, come on over here. We'll catch one. And he said, nah, I kind of like it where we're fishing. And I kind of growled a little bit. And I said to Eddie, the camera guy, you want to get a muskie on tape? He said, yeah. I said, you should start your camera because I'm going to cast right there and catch one. And he looked at me. He said, are you shitting me? I said, no. So I got it rolling. I made the cast and it went about 4 feet and a 25 pounder ate it. And I got him up to the boat and said, what do you want to do with it? But then Spencer and Roland came over and we unhooked it and they put it in their live well. And I said, there's probably going to be one, maybe two more here. They're going to be just downstream, just a little bit. And so just tie your boat up to me. And we're going to move out just a little bit. So we moved down about 15 feet. And I said, just start casting. And they started casting. And they weren't using the right stuff. And they weren't bringing it in the right direction. And they were moving it way too quickly. And I was using a lure we had just developed, a friend of mine and I. And I said, I looked at Eddie. And I kind of rolled my eyes. And I made a cast. And I see this fish coming. And he flashed. And I jerked my bait out of the water. I said, the fish is right there. Just cast and do what I told you. And the Petro, oh, you are so full of blah, blah, blah. You would never have blah, blah, blah. And he didn't know me. I looked at him. I made a cast. I jerked it about four times, and this fish eats it right 15 feet from the boat. And I'm fighting it, and I see another flash. I told, cast. So Roland now, smart enough, put the lure on that I gave him, made a cast, boom, now we have the double. So I landed mine and his got off right next to the boat. And these guys were like, oh, whoa, we got, I'll tell you the rest of it because it involved the other fish and another lure that wasn't involved. And there was some TV theatrics and magic that I had never witnessed. I didn't know anything about that. And they were happy with what they had gotten. And said, well, let's go. We're done. And so we left another 10 fish behind that I think I probably could have caught. And they went away. And then a while later, I got a call from Al Linder. And we went fishing. And he asked me if I would write an article and do a segment in their TV show about fly fishing. And so that's how I got into that. Did that for a while. And then got out of that. You thought it was not right to be in the sales business and in the media business both. So I actually gave my rep business away to a guy that was working with me. Tommy Anderson, super guy. He was a sage rep here for a million years. A lot of guys know Tommy. And went to work for the Inn Fisherman and did that for, several years. And I got kind of bored with, their whole formula was F plus L plus P equals success, which at the end of the day boils down to getting as close as you can with live bait and dropping it over the top of something is usually... And it was somewhat oversimplified, and it's a small world, and I was curious about a lot of different things. And so I wanted to go find out a bunch of stuff. So I started the – so I came home, and we'd had a meeting in Fisherman, and the powers decided that B wanted to really focus on this walleye tournament business and the tournament angling and so on. And I was more interested in where – we're going to be in the walleye tournaments. Let's go in places where people don't know how to catch them, where they're hard to catch and so on. And that way we grow it. But to go to where it's already, it's hyperventilating and already hyperventilating group of people. And it doesn't grow the body like as it should, I don't think. And it's boring. For me as a kid, we had to have the freezer full of walleyes before we could fish muskies. So I looked at them as a form of punishment. Fun to catch, But anyway, I decided I'd go off on my own. And started the hunt for big fish. And I guess that would be in the early 1990s.
Big call. Because back then you had to, so you would have been buying airtime. Were you trying to arrange all your sponsors and
yeah, I was doing it all. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Did you stay in Wisconsin the whole time? Or did, when you said that you moved out for a job?
Where I was born was right on the border of Wisconsin and Minnesota. And when I went to, in the rep business, I just stayed where, you know, where I was at. And then when I went to work, I went to work full time for the Fisherman, produced their TV shows, I guess, 4, 5, 6 years. I didn't remember how long. Then I moved to Brainerd. But it's too far from the airport. That's 3.5 hour drive to Minneapolis airport. So I had to find something a lot closer to the airport. So I moved to where I live now in Taylor's Falls, Minnesota, which is about an hour from Minneapolis. And, 25-30 minutes from where I was born.
Gotcha. Okay, so you stayed in the general vicinity.
Yeah. I don't have time in my life to learn another area as well as I know where I am. And I think most anglers, you know, you have a lot of anglers that are fish chasers that are chasing a hot bite or something, but and that's great. But what I've learned is that if you learn a body of water you really, really well, that I mean, really learn it so you can catch them when they're quote unquote not biting. You can take that and transpose it to another body of water. And so if you approach it where you break your flowing water into categories, types of rivers, and then you take still water and break it into lakes based on their age. I break it into the system that we used it in Fisherman, the oligotrophic lakes that age into mesotrophic and eutrophic. And fish behaviors are all similar within that. And by looking at angling that way, it allows you to go pretty well anywhere and figure it out. You know, most fly anglers are not very good at that at all.
Yeah. We're going to talk about that because when I think of you, I think of you as a fly fisher, but I really do think of you as an all-rounded angler because, well, you are. So before we dive into talking about fisheries and skill and all that fun stuff, when you broke free and started doing your own television show, what was the biggest surprise to you with all of that? I know it was a long time ago, but...
Well... You have to understand, I've been producing TV shows for many years prior to me going out on my own, where I did a lot of the shooting myself. I'd rather shoot myself. I really enjoy being on the side of the camera that's poking out at the fish. But no, not too many surprises because I didn't have any preconceived ideas. You have to have a preconceived idea kind of to be surprised, I think.
Yeah, it's true. So you had the show for 25 years?
Somewhere like that. I was surprised about one thing. I was surprised at how easy it was to catch some, like certain fish that were, I was, you. What's big, you know, the hunt for big fish, what's big? Well, the only way to look at, okay, what's the world record? That must be big. And in many cases, they were our fish that were ignored and so on, but many that weren't. And I was actually surprised. The first time I went, I thought, well, I'm going to go. I had some stuff figured out. In fact, I've got a lot of stuff figured out that I have not necessarily shared because of various reasons. It wouldn't, well, I had this thing figured out with big lakers, so I thought I'd go with flies. And in the first short period of time, every line class record. And in the time it took me to go back to shore and be dicking around, weighing it and measuring it and doing what I was doing, I could have caught five more of them. And I thought, you know, this is really silly. And it'd be better just to, okay, the records are this, here's this. Am I going to register this thing, mess around with it? I'll just figure this out. Because you can't figure it out when you're sitting there on the bank. You got to continue and make sure that what you did wasn't an accident It has to be repeatable. Otherwise, it doesn't count. It becomes superstition. And superstition has no place in angling. So anyway, that surprised me how simple it was to break a lot of these, to do that. That surprised me.
Okay. So you went to how many different countries did you take the show to? Before we were rolling, you said you went to 89 countries.
Through 89 of them, I think, at last count. How many we've shot in wouldn't be that many because a lot of them are these little African countries that you go popping through. I've been to Africa, I don't remember how many times, like more than 20, I think 28 or something.
I saw that you fished for Nile perch. When people ask me my bucket list, that's one of my trips. Is it worth going on? Or is it a species worth targeting? Or is it overrated?
Nile perch are the first place I fished was Lake Victoria. I think that's second to Lake Superior in terms of size. And just one arm of a Weenum Bay. I could write a book about my trip to Lake Victoria, as a matter of fact. Caught a ton of them there, speed trolling, crushed them, actually. Found huge schools of them on extended fingers. Their movements were related to the sage effect that's created by that Scirocco that comes off of the desert. Every day in the morning, the desert starts to warm and it creates a thermal that rises and wind blows like crazy. It equalizes out sometime around noon, but it'll create almost 18 inches of tide that blows up into this big arm. And then when that runs out, there's a secondary fingers off of this big arm, Weenum Bay, that are adjacent to the main body of the lake. They have big concentrations of perch on them that crushed them speed trolling in maybe 18 to 30 feet of water on these shelves, stair steps. And then there's other ones that go out and suspend near, structural elements, behave a lot like any other freshwater fish. I had a boat that was a hollowed-out canoe that had to be 30 feet long that took a football field to turn around in. And I lost a couple real, real big ones. So we're well over 100 pounds because I couldn't get the boat turned there. The behavior of the fish, fished them in the reservoir above Aswan, and we caught one there that was, I bet it was 2 1/4, 225 pounds probably. And then a lot of smaller ones. Those were related to mid-lake stuff, and they were pre-spawn. It was February. The lower third of the reservoir and the middle were all pre-spawn fish. The top third, the big fish we caught was actually a post-spawner, which is very, very interesting. And their behavior is they're migratory. They chase various types of stuff around. I don't know the creature that they eat. I don't know its name, but it looks like a baby tarpon, what the real big ones eat. But it depends on the time of year. There's weed patches. I mean, I'd have to draw this. The people I first fished with, okay, and the ass one, the guys are blind. Most of the people, I mean, I'm not bragging, man, but I'm with a guy. First, I'd get out the map. I'd tell him, show me, do you know? He says, no, the map is here. Went, okay, fine. We fish for 3 days and we don't get a bite. 3 days of 10 hours a day. And he's driving and he's got this goofy boat that they build right there that tip over real easily. They're made out of steel. And he's got some goofy motor on it that's half diesel and half gas. So at low speed, it's running on one, higher the other. I've never seen one like that. So it had a, as it would transfer. So anyway, and I've got a real depth finder with me, but we're using his little toy. And I finally pulled to my side. I said, man, I've been doing this quite a while and I've never really failed. We've come here a long time, a ways. You've had 3 days. We haven't caught a fish. If you keep driving and we don't catch anything, it'll be your fault. If you let me drive and we don't catch anything, it'll be my fault. So I convinced him to let me drive. And so, I set up a real depth finder. And first thing you got to find the river channel. When you're in a reservoir, where the hell's the river channel? and it's February, so I know it's, you know, winter, and there's things that happen. There's this really weird deal that happens at the, and I haven't got it totally figured out yet, but it's got to do with the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn. Things that happen inside of that, movements are dictated by high water, low water. You get north and south of that, they're dictated by temperature and seasonal changes and water fluctuations. And it is a fascinating thing. Anyway, that's a whole nother, where was I going? Anyway, I just pop straight out until where's the river channel. We roll out. I hit like 350. So I hit the, you know, I'm following this river channel, going along, looking for, you know, trying to get some, you know, picture in my head of what's what. Because I do have a map of what it looked like before they flooded it. So I know where the old cataracts, those are rapids, were and so on. And anyway, we're cruising along and he's starting to grumble, you know, because we're out in the middle of nowhere, he thinks. And then I see this big wind line and this bubble line, and then some just like on a North Dakota reservoir where there'd be a big mud line coming off of an island, and I'm on the channel, man. And it looks to me like this, I'm going to hit an outside bend on a river channel that's like, you know, my spidey sense, the buddies of fish, and they tell me my tail wiggles sometimes again. Or, you know, they're going to be here. they're up here, and I'm looking ahead about a mile, and he's, no, Nile Perger, never adjacent to the dead. And he's getting this bunch of horse stuff. So we get there. I was like, mom, 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 mom. I'm seeing these great big hooks on the screen. They're as big as my eyebrows, but they're down like 85. And I just stopped the boat. And I dug through a bunch of stuff, and I had some wire. I always brought a spool of wire line with me, stranded wire, 7-strand. And I hooked up because you could take, we used to speed troll 40 feet of water with spoon plugs with this stuff. And it's right underneath the boat because it doesn't stretch and it doesn't have any resistance. So you can fish, you can get your gear right underneath you, and you could be moving real quick. So anyway, I cranked the transducer head just a little bit so I could anticipate. Hooked up this wire, and this guy thinks I'm nuts. Like I'm spinning around the first time, boom, we get one about 80 pounds, get it up. Oh, yeah. And then I hooked one up for my wife, another setup, and we had doubles, boom, 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 and we just crushed them. And nothing giant, though, just, you know, I mean, big, 85, 65, 90, but just one after the other. And then from then on, we caught him every day, just really, really railed on him. And I found out after the guy, to him, he thought Nile perch were like lions. He was describing to me that they would hide behind a rock and then come out and pounce and then go back. And they're solitary creatures. And it's just, it was pretty fun.
Well, when do you put down the fly rod and pick up the bait rod?
Well, that's really simple. Why was a fly rod designed?
You tell me.
As a weightless object that I cannot get to a fish any other way. That's what a fly rod was designed for.
So with that philosophy then, which is sounds about right, how do you feel about fishing big weighted streamers? Does that kind of defeat the purpose?
I downstairs I have a toolbox. I've got screwdrivers, wrenches, crescent wrenches, socket wrenches, hammers. They all have purposes. I can actually sometimes take my jackknife if I don't have a screwdriver and actually unscrew a screw with the sharp side of my jackknife. Might make it dull and I might wreck the screw or even break the blade off my knife, but oh, now it's even a better screwdriver.
So
I'm being a little facetious.
I know.
What happens? All right. It's more fun if you're good at casting a fly. There's nothing more fun than just then winging a fly and me and going to the tree and around the corner and and it's fun to fight a fish. on a fly rod, boingity boingity boing. It's fun. Now, are we fishing for dinner or are we fishing for fun? There are times where I can catch dinner more effectively on a fly rod than I can on anything. So to me, it's a tool. That's all. It's as simple as that. Growing up, I fly fished maybe 5% of the time. When I was guiding people, the only people my dad would let me guide were fly fishermen. He said, because they won't come back without you. They won't even know where they were. And he was a little insulting, but he didn't understand that they're just doing it because they want to bite, you know. Some of my favorite people that I ever fly fished with, there was a fellow named Crawford Johnson, Roman numeral three. Crawford's the guy that introduced Billy Pate to tarpon. They went to school together. Crawford was the grandson or the great-grandson of one of the founders of the Coca-Cola company, the Snyder family. And what Crawford used to love to do is go down and fish tarpon and just like break the, like don't even put, like bend it, break it off right behind the barb and just jump them two or three times and make them go away. And he would tell me that. And as a kid, I would just shake my head. I could not figure out why anyone would ever want to do anything like that. Well, I certainly understand it now. I want to see him jump.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that fly fishers don't tend to find fish the way that maybe conventional guys do.
No. I wouldn't say, well, conventional guys sometimes have trouble too. But fly fishermen tend to beat up on a spot for a long time rather than go ring a lot of doorbells. And it's because of it's a whole bunch of different reasons. In fly fishing, okay. This will make it easy. You know what how a Venn diagram works, where you make a circle and another circle overlaps it. Mm-hmm. Okay. In the whole world of fish, you got fish that eat each other. You got fish that eat bugs, and it overlaps. Crabs, shrimp are bugs in the saltwater world. Bugs don't have the ability to fight a heavy current. Most fish that you are trying to fool with a bug, the single most important element other than coming relatively close in terms of size and maybe color, is executing a drag free drift into a cube of space, the size of which, when a fish goes, pop, it goes in. And if you're good at doing that, you can crush these goofy bug-eating creatures, especially if they don't know you are after them. Once they know you're after them, every time you make a cast, it'll make them harder to catch next time you come back. But the world of bugs, I mean, that's what it's about. You can prove it over and 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 over, and I have a zillion times. People think it's the leader they see. Sometimes it is. Usually the leader, the thickness of the leader causes water to catch it, and then it screws up your drag-free drift and all that, and the fluorocarbons and the yitty, yitty, yitty. The key thing is a drag-free drift. Okay. Now, the other side of it is 180 degrees, where it's the speed, it's the movement. If you go back and read Isaac Newton of angling is an old physics professor named Elwood L. Perry, Buck Perry, and he invented a method of angling called spoon plugging. He also invented the term structure fishing, cover as it relates to angling, and so on. Okay. He's the guy that figured out most of what I think is the main body of knowledge in all of angling, and most people haven't even ever heard of him. Combine that with the early in fish stuff, that's the basis of modern angling, really. But anyway, speed and size, erratic action tend to trigger fish that are fish that eat each other. Oftentimes people say, oh, it's the wounded. A panic-stricken fish is more likely to be eaten than a wounded, barely alive one. Also, take non-mechanical erratic action as opposed to a steady mechanical action. Oftentimes, that's a trigger that a large predator watched this other thing go by. And then, I mean, you've seen it thousands of times in my lifetime, so there isn't any doubt about it. And so you have these two worlds that are 180 degrees apart from each other. The fly rod as a tool gives me a huge advantage in one area and a big disadvantage in another. So do you want to, I can beat you with one hand tied behind me? Is that the game we want to play? Or I'm just going to catch and give and then catch another one, another one, another one. So I can catch, if I want to catch a great big one, the odds say I'm going to need to catch 200 fish to catch one really big one. Okay, I better get busy. Because there are some times that the prime lie isn't always where the big, you just have to get through it. And if your goal is to catch a truly large one, you cannot screw around.
So if you're going after bass, and I'm just thinking about my own experience here because
largemouth or smallmouth?
Well, I'm talking Australian bass right now, just because it's what I've been fishing for right now. But let's go ahead and talk smallmouth. And I'm just thinking because my husband fishes a Sammy, you know, the little Sammies?
No.
They're a hard plastic lure and they're really expensive. And when he reels it in, this thing kind of, it's just a topwater lure. And I fish one of your flies, which we'll talk about later. If you're fishing for if you're fishing a topwater pattern for an aggressive fish, and the whole goal is to keep it up in the water column and also, you know, strip it off of lily pads, would you prefer a bait caster or would you go with a fly rod? Because with your way of thinking, it seems like you'd want to go, like a fly might make more sense.
The how big are these creatures?
Good question. 2 to 4 pounds.
Okay. So a fly rod, when I hook them, some of them, if they go, wah, wah, I'm going to have to go in and get them, right? I can't just yank them out of there.
Well, it depends. Depends where we're fishing. But and it depends on the tide. And it depends if there's bull sharks around.
Oh, is it a estuary type thing?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and there's lily pads growing in that saline water?
Well, just up at the dam.
Oh, okay. See, I'm getting a picture of this because I don't see the salt water and the lily pads going together. Here's what the deal is. Those fish are living underneath those pads. That they've got a canopy over them, okay, as opposed to a jungle that's going to have alleyways through it. Those are short, blunt fish. That's why you're calling them bass, right?
Yeah, correct.
They're designed to turn corners. They're designed to ambush. They're not thin fish. So they live underneath a canopy. You throw something in there, all fish, I think that something that's really important, something I call the zone of awareness. They've got a zone of awareness that has a certain size and a certain shape. It's auditory, it's visual, and it's even olfactory, depending on some species. That's how salmon find where they're going to go. Some of them even have electro sensors. Paddlefish can sense plankton. The electrical.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, and sturgeon. It's the Ampullia lorenzini. They get this deal. But anyway, there's a zone of awareness. Here we have this little creature who's an ambush predator. He's living underneath a canopy. He's got a sun going back and forth every day. It starts in the morning, comes up. He's got a big, long shadow headed this way. And then that shadow will rotate around and get shorter and shorter and shorter at noon. What he'll do is find the place that's related to wherever he's sitting, where that little shadow thing is. And you, if that, and you can actually watch this little goofy little fellow move around sometimes during the day, very, very slowly to adjust to that. Now, if he's only, depending on how deep he is, his zone of awareness is a cone above his head where his, where his eyes are. And then he's got this auditory thing, depending on if the bottom's real hard or bottom's real soft, depends on how big of an effect that has. If it's real hard, you can hear it for a long ways. If it's soft, you can't. Anyway, in that kind of a situation, what you want to do, have it land, make a noise. I like divers as opposed to just one, but it has to, it makes a noise. There'll be a clicking noise if it hits the pad. If it lands on the pad, we had a mic underwater. It actually sounds like a click, but boom, land, make something move, stop. He's got a certain visual zone and it's got to be in it. You can run it through it quick. What I usually do first is fish real fast to find out if they really live there. In a deal like that, I'd have something with an up hook, and I'd probably use something that I'd call a slider or a skipper. But move, and then stop for some period of time. That type of a fish will oftentimes orient himself, would sit and watch it for some length of time, and then kaboom. If he's in a group, then I'd move probably very quickly. You know, if they're groups of fish, and they'll sometimes have a movement in that type of habitat where they'll just start going on patrol on the edges of it, and they'll flush bait out of it. But other times they'll just sit there, and so it just depends. But usually in that cover, letting it sit for a bit in bass type creatures, especially a largemouth, is a good idea.
It has been a good idea. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
That's okay.
Your fly has landed me every single one that I have caught. It's super tidal based, it's a funky stream because it's tidal based and it's a dam, and they're not really bass. They're almost like an estuary perch. But anyway, let's talk a little bit about the Dahlberg Diver. How did that fly come to be?
Well, it started out, there's this grizzly old guy that came up to help build a fire tower. You know, he had built these lookout towers so you could look for forest fires back in the old days. And he was from somewhere in southern Wisconsin, and he had a fishing pal named Frank Suick. Mr. Suick invented a lure. It's known as a Suick, and it's a musky lure. Maybe you've heard of it. It's a very, very famous musky lure, been around forever. It has a metal tail in the back, and when you pull it, it dives, and then it dives like this, kind of hovers, and then it rises. And he brought one of these things up. My dad, we'd never seen one before, and every place, man, these muskies that had never seen the Suick just came up and ate it. And it just, as a kid, I was like, whoa. And I remembered that. And anyway, I was living on a lake, a Big Wood Lake. And there was a largemouth I was trying to catch on a popper. And it had come up and make a big wake and then kind of sit there with his fins doing this and not eat it. It was driving me nuts. And what I wanted to do was make a Suick. I wanted to make a fly that way I could get to dive and then come back up again. And I was trying all sorts of stuff, and I always made kites, and I made stuff as a little kid. So I had a pretty good understanding of aerodynamics and so on and so on. And man, if I make it so that you couldn't cast it, then I had this idea. I was using deer, and it was semi-flexible. So I made this shape out of a deer hair, and I had a long shank Aberdeen hook, like an old eagle claw that you just bend. And I made this thing. I went out to, had this little short dock. I flipped it in the water, blew, blew, it looked good. I jumped in the boat, took off to where this fish was, made a cast, and this thing came out after, and then went kind of a long strip. Just, you know, how sometimes a wake just kind of goes up and it folds over, and I caught it. And it was a 6 pound, 7 ounce largemouth. And he was like, yeah. And so let's see, I must have been, I can't remember the age I was, but that same day I was guiding Bert Cross, who was the president of 3M, who the guy I mentioned earlier, right? And I'm on the river, and and he had his pal with him, and we went down this place we call the slough. And I'd given his buddy a fly, just, it was I called them tinsel flies. I had also developed a material called, later became called flashaboo, and I was the only one that had it. And I invented flashaboo. You probably didn't know that.
I had no idea. I'm dumbfounded right now.
Anyway, I also thought I invented the muddler. I'd never seen a muddler, but I'd had this tinsel. That's a whole another story of where that came from. It was a lady that couldn't catch a fish, and we found it. But anyway, I'd given a fly to his buddy, and we had this deal. If you caught a 3.5 pound smallmouth, you'd get on a fly. You're on the honor roll, and it was fly fishing only club. So I'd given his buddy, it was a crummy fisherman, one of these flies, and he catches a 3.75 pounder. He's on the honor roll. Bert, who's been in the club for several years, this guy's his guest. Bert's never caught an honor roll. And so he's putting the heat on me because, you know, I had to, I said, Bert, okay, tell you what, I'll pull you up the mouth, and there's a big stair step there, and it is a mother to do. But the last mile or so is some of the best smallmouth fishing anywhere in this region. And so anyway, I pull him up this thing. We get this beautiful, beautiful eddy at the end of a 12-mile long run of fast water, you know, where it's just, it's super. And he throws his, he's got his popper or whatever the hell he's using. He's throwing it out, and he's, man, not getting bit. And I dig in my box, and I pick up this soggy diver, the first one ever made that I caught the 6 pound, 7 ounce on when the sun was coming up in the morning. And I'm squeezing it and blowing on it, and it smells really stinky, like a largemouth. You know how bad they smell compared to a smallmouth, you know. And I said, Bert, give me a line. And I'm tying this on, I says, you try this. And he says, what in the hell is that supposed to be? And I said, just throw it out there. And it was a diver with a big gold flashaboo tail. And Bert was using back then they owned Cy Anglers. And he had a Cy Angler System 10. Those are great rods. They're built, they were hardy rods. I think the J.K. Fisher actually made the blanks. They're really great, great rods, spigot ferrules. Anyway, Bert fires this thing out, this big sloppy 10 weight, and the line is getting, you know, he's just tightening up his line. And then the current catches the line a little, and he gives it a pull, and it goes bloop, and bloop, a smallmouth hits it, and he gives it a big yoke, and the fly comes back and lands in the wrong side of the river. And then he spins around in his chair, and he's going to tighten up again, and blam, another one hit it. And he caught that one, and we're landing it. And he says, Larry, I think you got something here. And that was the beginning of the diver. And that's why I made it.
So did nothing else like that exist at the time?
No, not even close. People thought as flies, as lures. They weren't thinking them as dynamic objects. And there was only a small number of popper heads available. And, I don't know. People just didn't think about stuff that way.
So have I been fishing it wrong the whole time? I've been enjoying your sound effects. And at one point when you were imitating how it sounds in the water, you almost went, don't make fun of me here, but it was like,
yeah, you can make them. It depends on the caller. I've never done a video or done it. I think I did one video on the In Fisherman. We did a fly fishing for pike thing way long ago. And then, oh boy, I don't remember when. And I showed how I tie a mega diver. But other than that, I've never written an article or done any videos on the variations. There's many, you know, it's a concept. It's a diving lip. We've got crankbaits, you know, they have many diving lips, different depth and stuff, but it's flexible. And that's one of the, you can make it flexible. And so you can make it do different things. And one of the things that's really effective is just a long strip. So you get a long bubble chain. That bubble chain is so visible. It's ridiculous. And it makes it's a real effective trigger oftentimes.
Yeah, because when I strip it back, it's a big bloop, and it creates such a bubble that, I mean, it literally separates the water around it as it's coming forward. So are you saying that to make it go bloop, that it's in how it's fished or how it's tied?
Both.
Okay. Both.
The caller has to say supported, and then if you pull it far enough, you get a chain, a strip, a string of bubbles.
Wow. And can you actually?
And then a lot of times, one of the most effective ways of, if I was like, let's say I'm fishing a steelhead, and they're pretty aggressive sometimes. And especially, you know what, you can make them be aggressive, and it hasn't got to do with them wanting to be aggressive. It's you pushing them with something. It's like hot shotting. You know, a hot shot where you take a diving lure, you put them behind your boat, start at the top end of the pool, and you kind of back down, over, down, over, down, over, and you get them into the tail out, and they'll come up and snap at the bait, but it's got to be making bottom contact, the bottom contact.
I think it's illegal now, but yes.
Okay, it's highly effective.
I bet.
So I'll take a diver, put it on a sinking line. I'll make a diver that wants to dive 6 inches on a floating line. Then I'll take a sinking line, let the line lay, make the line be on the bottom, and then strip. And the fly will want to go 6 inches deeper than the line is. And so the fly goes, grinds into the bottom. If you get, oop, it's stuck, you just give a little slack and a little bit of a shake, and oop, it floats back up again. So you can actually make bottom contact and grind it like a crankbait. And I've had incredible success doing that. Or on if we're on a weed line in you have natural lakes in Australia. Let's just, you know, view in your own mind. We're in 1 foot, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 feet of water. It's a fairly clear body of water. We get into 10 feet of water and we have weeds rooting in 10 feet, but we get deeper than 10 feet. We don't have any weeds left, right? It's called a weed line. And then we follow that weed line is on a break line that's got a certain shape to it. And there'll be a little point sticking out. And there's a little bunch of fish hanging there. And I'm wanting to fish that weed line. And sometimes as the day is changing and so on, the fish will suspend up like that. Or sometimes it'll be right at the base of the weed line. And what I can do is get parallel. Let's say I've got an eight foot weed line. I could take put on a 10 foot leader, a sinking line, and you want to make bomber gas. All your fly line parallel to the weed line. Let the fly line hit the bottom. Your fly is still on the surface. Makes a strip. You can let it go back up, or you can go strip, 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 strip. And the fly will swim all the way down and bump the bottom. Now we can stop, and the fly will go head up and slowly go all the way back to the surface. So you could fish an 8 or 10 foot water column. Or you could, there's a number of things that you can do. You can use it as a reference where you, how can I put it? Okay, if we're we're in 20 feet of water, there are fish 10 feet below the surface. I take a floating line and a sinking fly. I throw it out, let it sink 10 feet. I can strip it. It comes up. I strip it, comes up. But in most cases, I get going with it and it's going to come up to it's to shallow. Take a sinking line, sinking fly, throw it out, let it sink. I'm hung up all the time. I don't know where I'm at. I can take a floating fly, sinking line, and then a leader that's 10 feet long. And in 20 feet of water, keep that fly either somewhere between the bottom and that 10-foot area. And a floating diving fly or a dive, any floating fly fished on a sinking line with a leader that's appropriate length to put it where you need it in the water column. Fishing depths 20 feet and shallower, it's a pretty effective method.
Yeah, no doubt. Do you fish it on a bait caster as well or just on a fly rod?
On a fly rod.
Gotcha. Yeah,
I do think, you know, there's many other ways that I can accomplish. The diver is a modification of a fishing lure.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you just have to understand what you can get away with. If you start putting too much weird stuff on them, you hit yourself in the head with the fly, and that's no fun. You know, if it isn't fun to cast a fly, I ditch it. Fly fishing, for me, I love to do it. It's fun to cast. Unless you got a fly you're fighting with, then it's not. Simple.
How do you feel about all the variations that are now on the market of your fly?
Oh, I'm deeply flattered. Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Mm-hmm. You're quite the inventor, and I wanted to ask you about this reel. I think I read something about a reel handle.
Oh, it's not a it's a fishing rod handle.
Oh.
Yeah, many years ago, back in the old days, conventional outfits, bait casting outfits, had offset handles. And they had a ferrule made by the Featherweight company, most of them made out of aluminum, and then the blank chucked inside of it. At the time, a bass, one of those things, if I put pressure on it, they would shear at 12 or 14 pounds of pressure. And the whole system weighed somewhere probably 14 ounces or so with the handle and the so on. And then Lou Childrey brought the Fuji system from Japan over here. They actually had a sumo wrestler in a phone. It was unbelievable. He had a great big pan reel. The fishing rod, put it in a holder-like deal. And then the rod had a rope kind of, you know, heavy, heavy line going through it, went down through a pulley, and then this sumo wrestler, glass booth, cranking it, pow, wowie, it would explode and show how many pounds. And then they'd put the Fuji handle on it, do the same thing, when it would break it, like 20 pounds instead. They closed him down at the ICAST show, and they made him put other people what they do is take the Browning rod or the Fenwick rod, put it in the Fuji system, and it was actually stronger than the Fuji rod, but it was the ferrule. And so I saw this, and that was interesting. And during this period of time when I was at the retail sporting goods store, I'd started rod building stuff, and I was studying actions of rods and how many pounds you would get under how much pressure. And how many pounds I would give away, you know, I lift this much, I only get this much as it gets longer and longer. And then I was studying the impact curve when you set hooks. And the rods we were using had a parabolic taper. And they were quite stiff, but what would happen, that it would be a real steady curve before you put pressure on. They weren't good at setting hooks on a muskie, which has a lot of teeth. They'd bite down a wooden bait, and you have to have a boom impact. So I found these actions that were popping rod shafts that were like 8.5 feet long. I take a section of them, and they were stiffer in the butt. I have to remember we had fiberglass then, and had a different curvature at the tip that would actually produce a bump where if I had a curve, it looked like that, where boom, you'd get a much sharper impact at hook set. You couldn't get as much total pressure if you wind down and wind and pull because the rod doesn't bend down to the butt, but it would give you a pop. And they were also really lightweight because they had thin walls and they were large diameter. And anyway, it was a rage. Everybody was wanting them. But you had to build them with a straight handle because the ferrule systems weren't large enough to accommodate this fat blank. So my dad didn't like the straight handles. And so I wanted to make him one of these rods because they were so much better. Then Lou Childrey, Fuji, came out with the a ferrule that was large enough to fit it. How wonderful. Built one. Take it fishing. He has a fish strike his lure. He sets and it breaks off at the ferrule. Well, the Fuji ferrule was better because it was seeding over a period this long. The Featherwhite ferrule had a little thing that was 3/8 of an inch solid aluminum and then a little sleeve that the blank went in. The Fuji was fatter back here, so the blank would seat over about 4 inches, except on the new big one, which only seated at the end, and it was too fat to actually plug all the way in. And so it's not going to work. So I'm scratching my head. And all of a sudden, bing, I get an idea. What I did was got big fat corks, and instead of having it drilled in the middle, I plugged the middle and I drilled it way off in the edge. So now I've got an offset cork way up high on a shaft that went through. And we just, I could offset them in different directions. Different amounts and make it look like an actual pistol grip. You know, it was like an optical illusion with a blank going through, but you still had the same effect because relatively it was recessed relative to the cork. So you had the same feel as a offset handle, but the blank went all the way through it. Well, instead of weighing 14 ounces, it weighs 3.25 ounces and it breaks at like 28 pounds.
Whoa.
Yeah. So we got a group together. I had a friend who I'd met while I was at the store who was, he was involved in the stock business and various stuff. You know, it's far over my head. We started this little company. We raised a little bit of money and we got a patent on this. And then they took it to a group of investors. It's called a private placement or something. There's a limited number of people that get to see it and so on. And I'd drawn up a marketing plan where I could take helium balloons about the size, a little bigger than your head, and tie them onto my rods and they would float in the air. And then I could take the same helium balloons and tie them to anybody else's fishing rods and they'd lay out on the ground. And that was how we were going to display them. And so anyway, it's the night before the big, what it was called, AFTMA back then, not ICAST. And the night before that, I'm in a hotel room and I've got Jerry Gibbs, who is outdoor writer, main writer for Outdoor Life, super, super guy. And Mark Sozin. And I can't remember if Lefty was there or not. I think so. And one other writer who I don't remember. And we showed him this and they just thought, oh my God, that's the greatest innovation in 90 years. That's unbelievable. And we walk into the show that morning as it opens and I look in the background and way in the back corner, I see helium balloons floating all over the place and there's fishing rods hanging. Oh, I go look and there's the Berkeley Lightning rod. In the first year, we wanted, I think, 25 cents a rod royalty to use this. And first year, I think there was $85 million worth of infringing product. My partner in this, a fellow named John Brackett, somewhere has a letter and a file from the head of the rod and reel committee, a man named Joe Cootie, was president, I think, of Shakespeare at the time, saying, well, yeah, this is an important innovation, and but if we all stick together and ignore them, there's probably nothing they can do about it. And so I sort of got a, well, you know, I've kind of thought that might happen, and decided I was going to kind of tuck things away, probably till I get old enough to defend a patent. So I hadn't, and I did copyright Flashaboo, thank goodness. And a lot of people have tried to knock that off, but we've been able to maintain a pretty good position in that. Got some neat new stuff coming out, actually, with Flashaboo. But anyway, I went years, and then I, you know, in the TV show, one day I decided, you know, I make so many of my own lures. I wonder if the viewers would be interested in that. I'd made a thing I called a June spoon. My granddaughter had just been born. And, you know, as you know, tarpon like to jump and get off. And we're catching them on jigging spoons. So I made these spoons with a hole through. So you slide the line through, hook it up, fish bites, the jig slides up the leader. So I've got a hook in them so you don't have that 3 ounces of weight flopping around. And we showed how to do that on TV and started a little workshop segment within the show, and people really liked it. I got more letters about that than I did about anything else I'd ever put on. So we started this make lure thing, and then I started pulling some things out of one of my young fishing buddies was using a plopper type lure. And I said, Josh, I've got an idea. I've had it in my head for years how to make a better one of these things. And I made a thing with a much larger tail, and there's a different way that you bend them that I'd figured out when I was a little kid that makes a pop pop instead of a flip flip sound. And I made him one, and I think he caught 3-4 muskies on it the first day and just crushed fish with it. And then it turned into the whopper plopper, which I don't know, it's become a lot of people use it for a lot of stuff. So yeah, I like making stuff. I got a whole bunch of neat stuff that I haven't shown. It's got some stuff I don't even dare show anybody, actually.
Well, I bet you, yeah, you're probably a little bit gun shy now. Why did you stop the show?
You know, I got old and I got tired, and it got more and more difficult to get it all done. It was important for me to do it as to do the best that I could do as the years moved on. The people that sponsored these things wanted to wait longer and longer to make commitments. When I started doing this, I'd get commitments in January for sure commitments so I could operate on a budget and produce material that I'm going to edit the following November and December, perhaps. When you start getting commitments in July, it's pretty difficult to put together a good string of shows using July, August, September, October. When am I going to edit? If you're going to be an effective angler, you have to understand calendar periods, and you need to go when your odds are the best. And well, if you're, it made it nearly impossible. And I'd seen what I kind of wanted to see. I had certain goals. I want to figure things out. I don't know. For me, I need to understand the program. I need to go there and be able to have repeatability and understand. I fished because I'm interested kind of in the natural world and how all of it is hooked together. And I like to, I don't know. It's an existential thing. I'm not comfortable unless I've got a kind of a grip on it. And I need to be there for a little bit, you know. I always like to see, you know, what the other people have done, you know, let the natives always have an excuse where you should have been here or there, but they don't figure it out, you know. But it's good to hang with them 2-3 days, see what they want to do. And then as you're going, I always hook up my depth finder, so I'm watching, so I know where we are. And then you put the puzzle pieces together, ring the doorbell, the guy's home, proves you both exist. What a relief.
So what's your next goal then? Because you are obviously highly analytical. You're very smart. You're clearly goal driven. I don't know if you're, are you that driven these days, or are you kind of retired?
Oh, I like making stuff.
Yeah,
it's I like it. What I enjoy more now is kind of anglers go through a lot of different stages. You know, you first, you know, I just want to catch a fish. Next stage, maybe I want to catch a limit. Next stage is I want to catch a great big one. Next stage is I want to catch one how I want to catch one. That's maybe where the fly angler would come in. And then I've hit a stage where I enjoy sharing, and that's a dumb, because it's not really that. I like to go there where I know they are and take people that I enjoy being with that may or may not. I do enjoy fishing with really skilled anglers, but I enjoy fishing with people that maybe not so skilled that are enjoying it, as long as they're serious about it. And that doesn't mean you're frowning. It just means don't dick around. I mean, really, you know, we're fishing here and it's fun to laugh and giggle, but let's not overdo the laughing and giggling. We're still fishing here. Let's listen. So the next time we can do it right, you know, not right, but we don't have that same problem, or, you know, whatever. There's a, you know,
there's a time and a place. So what are you doing nowadays? Are you, you're not taking people out, are you? Are you hosting trips? What are you doing?
Yeah, I've never done that. I like I said, I fish with my three friends. And since COVID, you know, I was in Trinidad when the COVID thing broke out. That's the last place I've been out of the country. That was exactly 2 years ago, 1 week ago. So I spent the last couple of summers just hanging around home. Had a lot of fun last summer. I actually was counting them. I think we boated 107 muskies. And didn't really fish all that many days, but really had a lot of fun days. They're all fun. I look forward to them. I mean, I know what's wrong with me. Sometimes I get bored, but snowing right now.
Yeah,
it's 65 4 days ago here, and it's snowing right now.
That's cold. That is cold. I'm obviously Canadian, and we were just back in Canada December, January, and wow, I forgot how cold it gets.
Cold sucks.
It sucks.
Cold is bad, warm is good. Yeah.
Can't even get out.
Yeah, we're going to have spring. We'll have spring in about 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's not far off. Well, look, I feel like I would like to ask you a lot more questions about specific fishing situations, but I won't do that now because it's late here and early for you. This is a really silly question, but how many have you? You've written books, yeah?
Let's see. I was involved with a couple of pretty boring ones, but no, I haven't written a book yet.
You haven't written your own book yet?
No, I started. And I got a whole bunch of chapters done. Actually kind of done, did it on a, you know, recording thing, and then it spit it back out. And then when I went back into re-edit, it drove me nuts. And it happened at a time, my buddy, I had a friend in South America, his name was Cesar Calor. We shot a lot together. And he got killed in a plane crash. And that kind of changed it as far as, me writing the book, it changed what it would be about in a lot of ways. What our plan was to do was go down and do I was telling you about that band of space between the two tropics where the seasons are dictated by rainfall, not by temperatures. And what I wanted to do is go down there with him. He spoke five languages and do kind of the same. You break down the physical features, and you break down the seasonal things as it relates to angling and peacock bass, dorados, paihara. And I kind of wanted to go do that, and that would have been something that would be a contribution to the body of knowledge, which is what drives me. You ask the question. To me, it's just if you can add to the body of knowledge, that's the single most important thing, because fishing is such a frivolous activity anyway. You know, we could be out, you know, discovering a cure for cancer or a better way to grow wheat. You know, we're making a living fishing.
Yeah. Don't discredit yourself. I'd still buy your book. I would absolutely love to read what you have to say. Well, listen, I'm going to wrap this up. I know that there's going to be a lot of questions. I can already see the comments now of, why didn't you ask about bass fishing this? Why didn't you ask about thermocline this? Why didn't you ask about patterning this? I can already see the questions rolling in.
Yeah, thermocline and turnover stuff is a thing that people really don't understand very well at all. And most of the information is wrong.
Let me bring you into that, because that's actually something I'm also very curious about. And I know you've got to go, but when it does come to the thermocline, did you want to just explain that and your thoughts on that?
Okay. It depends, of course, latitude and sun and water depth and all that kind of stuff. Let's just take a basin of a body of water. All right. And we're just going to talk thermocline, not talk about turnover. All right.
Right.
All right. So it's a nice day and the water is whatever it is. Let's pretend that it's 70 from top to bottom. And all of a sudden it starts to get warm. And now it's 70 down a foot and down a foot and down a foot and starts to get warm. And it might be 45 underneath it. There'll be an area that builds in between it that the temperature drops at about a degree and a half per foot. That's a thermocline. Degree and a half per foot. And then it's bang, real hard after that and real steadily warm above that. If the wind starts blowing, that thermocline can just go away tomorrow.
Right.
Okay. If it sets up, and the larger the body of water is and the shape and the way the wind blows makes a difference. But anyway, it can set up, and I've seen it happen very often here. We're at 45 degrees north latitude, okay? And in our bodies of water that have a 35-foot basin depth, it is not uncommon in August for that thermocline to have moved from somewhere at 10, 12, 15 feet, and it got wider, and then that 70 degree or 78 or 75 degree water on top of it goes up and it squashes it right down to the bottom, and there's no thermocline left. It's all just hot water from the top all the way to the bottom. So the thermoclines can be thick, thin. They can be set up over long periods of time. Usually they become most important when you're in larger bodies of water that have got a little bit deeper basin depths than 30 or 40, and where you'll set up a two-story fishery where you've got a bunch of guys living under it, and then you've got guys that are in it and above it. It just depends on how radical it is.
So what happens as that heat is starting to compress and press down? Where do the fish go?
The ones that were above it are still above it, and the ones that are below it just wind up being pressed to the bottom. If a perfect example, in fact, that's a great question. Okay. Let's say we want to catch a great big giant lake trout where it's the easiest time to catch them. We go to a body of water in Saskatchewan, northern, in the big lake trout zone, okay? And we're going to pick lakes that are 140, 150 foot maximum depth. And what we'll do is just run right out to the crack, go find the deepest crack in the lake, go there, and every single lake trout in the whole lake, all the big ones are laying right there in that crack during that period of time. And it's the worst possible time of the year to try to catch them. And to get them, you have to use a ball of lead, be bouncing it off the bottom. We used to use big herring dodgers that were 24 inches long. They were dodgers that we'd use as lures and then, put a big hook on. And what that did was this system, the thermocline got pressed down to the bottom, and it forced the fish that are second story fish to be down into the tiniest little cracks that are left. And so there's time you can use it to your advantage. The other time that you would have caught these big giant lake trout is when the water temperature in the spring hits exactly 48 degrees. And at 48 degrees, they will be in those shallow water streams eating an Arctic sucker that spawns there. At 52, they will be gone. There will be nothing. At 53, 48 to 52, they are there. You can jump up. You want to go catch a great big giant lake trout on a fly, jump in an airplane. You get a thermal you know, those little things that you shoot at a, you know, laser, temperature teller. It's a little laser and you can shoot it against your water pipe and it'll say 3 degrees or against your manifold of your truck and it'll tell you the temperature. You can jump in a float plane in the springtime when the ice is going out of these great big lakes. All right. Jump in a float plane and you run over the shallows and you run over the tributaries and you can take water temperatures. And these fish are so pinned. You'd be there every day at 47, at 48 degrees, bam, they're there, just as certain as you are alive. And then there'll be a 4 degree swing and it might last a week. It might last 3 days. 3 days, they're there, guaranteed 100%, 100%. And you can find these goofy things by doing that. And you get a lake that's 140 miles long. It would take you 5 days to try to sniff out with a boat. You can do it in a half an hour if you know what you're looking for.
Is this lake trout specific or all species?
The temperature range that I gave you is lake trout specific. The sniffing technique depends on what you're hunting for.
Right. Dun, dun, dun. How did you figure that out?
I don't know. It just came into my head.
You
first,
we were
landing. I'd just land the plane and go dig, dig, dig. You know, we'd land, float plane, but it's much quicker to just go by.
Gotcha.
Did the same thing in Alaska. That's how we find this big giant pike in Alaska. Is a buzz them.
Is there a magic temperature with muskie?
Of course, there's magic temperatures with everything having to do with their seasonal movements.
Will you share?
Which one are you looking for? Springtime,
muskie?
Six. No, which time? Spring or fall? They're different.
The fall.
If you want it, you want to go catch a great big muskie on a fly. I wrote an article. I've read a lot of articles. You ask me about books. No, articles a lot. Somewhere in the IGFA comes out once a year. IGFA annual.
Oh, they're,
you know what I'm talking about.
Publication.
The
yep.
Fishes of the America or of the world or whatever it is. Years ago, I wrote a piece in that about how to catch a muskie on a fly. And the most high odds way. And that is, you go to a northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, southern Ontario, clear body of water in springtime when the shallows are going to approach 60 degrees. And you, what warms up at the when is dictated by bottom content and where it is on the lake. The northwest corner always warms up more quickly, but not always, because it could be the wrong color bottom or this or that, or blah, 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 blah. And not everybody, not every place warms up at the same time. And anyway, at 60, they start rolling in and you'll see fish that are belly to the bottom. You'll see some fish that are suspended. The ones that are belly to the bottom, if you are sneaky and you do what I described to you earlier with the sinking line and take a first rip diver, it doesn't have to be any longer than five, six inches long. And most people don't tie them right. The ones that have been made by the factory have never been right. The heads are okay. But instead of making a straight strip like this, these pre-cut straight strips, that isn't what you want. You want to make it in a taper like that, like the two insides of my fingers. That way they cast way, way better. They swim better. They work just way, way better. But anyway, you spot this fish, make your cast, maybe get so it's 6-8 feet in front of him. Let the line sink to the bottom. You just strip, 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 and let that little thing come, maybe bump bottom, come back up, and you catch just about everyone that you see. And then the ones that are up high, you just sort of, there's different ways that you mess with them and tease them. But during that period, you can catch, I mean, you can catch everyone you see. do it right.
Lake St. Clair, here I come.
St. Clair's real dirty. That would not be a good choice.
Oh, no. Darn it.
No, that's a good place to go blind cast them, but it's the least fun place I can think of to fish them because it's a great big wide open weed flat. And it can get real, real dirty due to wind, and you're wide open and in the wind. And what's interesting about the most interesting thing to me about muskies is they seem, and I'm not a superstitious person, some of them seem almost sentient, where they'll come up and they'll follow something and roll their eye and look at you and then swim away. And that's kind of fun. But in areas where you have more of a target, I think you'd have a lot. It's a lot more interesting, and in clearer water, it's a lot more interesting. Where you want to go, I used to fish them on Rowan a lot in southern Ontario. But we have
just going to say Ontario, yeah.
Northern Minnesota, especially western Minnesota. Really, really some excellent musky fishing and nice, clean, clear water. It's just a matter of being there at the right time.
I'm going to let you get back to your morning. Thank you so much for waking up so early to meet with me. This is definitely two very different time zones, so I'm amazed that we were able to make this work.
Well, I don't think you should be that amazed.
I guess in
2022. 10 isn't that late and 4 isn't that early, you know?
I think 4 is that early. I will say that 10 p.m. is not too late, but I feel like 4 a.m. is very early.
Well, like I said, the early worm gets eaten.
Awesome. Well, listen, Larry, thank you so much. I think you're just an absolute legend, and I'm very excited to have other people hear your story and see what you're up to next.
All right. Well, thank you, and have a nice night.
And that concludes this episode of Anchored.